It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Getting into arguments with your partner doesn't mean your relationship is doomed to fail. In fact, if we do it right, conflict can actually strengthen our relationships. Our next guests are PhD clinical psychologists and relationship therapists, and in their new book, they dig into the right and wrong ways to fight with our significant other. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you and your significant other ever fight? Do you avoid conflict at all costs? Have you received any valuable relationship advice about relationship conflict that you'd like to share? Do you have questions about how to navigate conflict in relationships? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Schwartz-Gottman is co-founder and president of the Gottman Institute. She's the lead author of the new book, Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
And John Gottman is co-founder of the Gottman Institute, co-author of Fight Right, and an alumnus of UW-Madison. John, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
Now, Julie,
really enjoyed. Yeah.
Julie, I think sometimes we think of, you know, an argument in a relationship as an inherently negative sign, but you really make the case in the book that's not true. Why is that?
Well, here's why. You know, a lot of people think, first of all, that anger is a bad thing, which it is not. In our research, what we really saw was the way that people express their anger makes all the difference. What we also saw in our research of 3,000 couples following them for as long as 20 years is that the successful couples who had long-lasting relationships did fight. They did have conflicts, but they used those conflicts as a way to really unearth something very important to their partner, and they also got to express what was really important to them. They did the conflicts in a really different way than the unsuccessful couples who ended up splitting up or staying unhappy in the relationship. So our research showed us that if conflicts are done right, thus Fight Right is the title, we really can use those conflicts as a royal road to understanding our partners.
And John, before we get into those lessons, I want to talk a little more about the research that you've been doing, as Julie just mentioned, for decades now. You two aren't just winging it here. Can you talk about how you have researched and watched couples as they talk about contentious issues to try to draw the conclusions you get to in the book?
Yeah, Rob. About 52 years ago, my colleague Robert Levinson and I designed a lab that synchronized the video time code. We filmed two people talking about an issue, talking about how their day went or a positive topic. And Julie and I designed an apartment lab where newlyweds lived for 24 hours, and we filmed them while they were awake. And in these labs, we really not only videotaped them, but we also synchronized that to the physiology that was going on, their heart rate, their blood velocity, their respiration, how much they were sweating and moving around, all these measures together. And then we had couples rate how they felt after each conversation. So they would watch the video again and turn this dial that went from very negative to very positive. And in the beginning, we just sent them home. We didn't know how to help anybody. But we tried to get representative samples in the places that we worked and followed them for a long period of time. But in the past 26 years, Julie and I have used our ability to predict the future of a relationship with over 90% accuracy, used that information to really help couples and tested our interventions. And so they really do work.
Julie, I want to get into one of the biggest mistakes, or how, let's call them four of the biggest mistakes. You talk about people in that moment of an argument in a relationship falling prey to the four horsemen of bad fighting. What are they?
Yes, we call them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, doom and disaster. So here's what they are. The first one is criticism, and that shows up particularly when bringing up an issue, but can occur anytime during the fight. And criticism means blaming a problem on a personality flaw of your partner. For example, saying something like, "You're just too lazy to clean up the kitchen." You know, there's the blaming and criticism. The second horseman is contempt, and contempt is the worst of all of them. It's like sulfuric acid on a relationship. Similar to criticism, again, it's pointing out a flaw of the partner, but doing so from a position on high, very superior. So cutting sarcasm is an example, calling your partner bad names or mocking your partner. All of those are expressions of contempt. You wouldn't even think of getting your hands wet to clean the kitchen, would you? You know, there's contempt for you, right? And contempt not only predicts the demise of a relationship, it also predicts the demise of the listener's immune system. We saw that the number of times a person heard contempt from their partner in 15 minutes predicted how many infectious illnesses they would have in the next four years. Isn't that incredible? So the third horseman that doesn't work well in a fight is defensiveness. And defensiveness is, you know, one of the most common of the horsemen. When we feel attacked, either by criticism or contempt, our natural instinctive response is going to be defensiveness, where we either counterattack by saying something, "Oh, yeah, well, you didn't pay the bills on time," or whining, "I did too do the dishes," you know, that kind of thing. That's defensiveness. And the fourth one we call stonewalling. That's when one partner completely shuts down in the middle of a conversation and stops giving the other person any sign that they've heard what that person is saying. They don't nod their heads. They don't say little things like, "Mm-hmm, oh, I see." None of that. What we discovered about stonewalling is that many people who shut down like this are actually in fight or flight. That's where the physiological measures that John just mentioned come in. They're in fight or flight while sitting there because they're feeling so attacked. Their heart rates will be over 100 beats a minute, sometimes as high as 180 beats a minute. The only thing to do there is to take a break of a specific kind.
Talking to Julie Schwartz Gottman and John Gottman, their new book is called Fight Right: How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. They're sharing decades of their work as clinical psychologists and relationship therapists. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe an experience to share. That's 800-642-1234. We were just talking, John, about the four horsemen there. Now, here's a rule that could point us maybe in a more positive direction. The 5-to-1 rule, which I'd heard of, but I didn't know exactly how it worked. What is the 5-to-1 rule?
Well, it's become real famous in Seattle. I recently went to a Starbucks and a guy drove by and rolled his window down and said, "Hey, 5-to-1, right?" And this is our magic ratio that Bob Levinson and I discovered. Is if you take all of the things somebody said during a conflict discussion and sort them into two bins, all the positive things that you can do, like nodding your head and listening and saying, interesting, good point, you know, and being affectionate, having a shared sense of humor. Take all the seconds of positivity and divide it by all the seconds where they've been defensive or hostile or counterattacking, all those negative things. The masters of relationship, the people who stay together liking each other and enjoying the marriage, those people had a ratio of 5 positive to 1 negative, which really surprised the heck out of me. I thought in a great relationship, they'd be balanced, you know, equal, the ratio would be 1. But no, it's 5-to-1. in the Masters. And in the disaster couples, couples who either broke apart or stayed together unhappily, that ratio was 0.8 to 1, just a little bit more negativity than positivity.
And a key point, Julie, is, and you address this in the book, why we fight, what we're trying to accomplish here. The correct answer is not to win the argument. How do we flip that around and try to get something positive out of that conflict?
First of all, we really need to understand that a lot of times what we're fighting about is not necessarily obvious. It's not the issue on the surface. Many times it may be something way down deep, a hidden dream that the person has about how life should be, or a value they have, or some background history. And what can happen with conflict is that when you pause and don't move into trying to solve it right away, but instead ask each person a series of questions that we describe in the book that really deepen your understanding of your partner's position on the issue, what ends up happening is you come out of that particular discussion with a much deeper understanding of your partner's position on the issue, and perhaps more compassion for them as well. After that, you can move into compromise in a much more gentle way because you have much greater understanding of what's really important to your partner, and you've had a chance to say the same in the midst of this discussion.
We're talking with clinical psychologist Julie Schwartz-Gottman and John Gottman about their new book. It's called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had that one issue that keeps coming up, a point of contention in a relationship? How did you navigate it? Did you dodge around it and ignore it? Or did you take it head on? Did it go well? Do you have questions for our guest about how to make conflict something productive in a relationship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with psychologists and relationship researchers Julie Schwartz-Gottman and John Gottman. Their new book is called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. You can join in with advice of your own to share an experience or questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. DJ is with us in Stevens Point. DJ, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had the first date with my spouse 40 years ago this weekend.
Wow.
Like for Valentine's Day. The best advice that I received before we got married was always put the other person's point of view and the other person first. And that was pretty good advice. I know that we have had less than a handful of screaming or, you know, yelling at each other fights in the 36 years we've been married, but it doesn't mean we don't still have conflict. When we get angry, we will talk. If I am about to say something that I know that I will regret and she will be angry about, I just hold my tongue if I can, and if I can't do that, I walk away for a while. When we see each other later, I think for both of us, the thing that happens ultimately, there will be, you reach out, hold a hand, something, whether it's that night next to each other once we've gone to bed without talking for a few hours or whatever, but just that contact, a little bit of a warm touch and not screaming at the other person.
DJ, thanks a lot for that call. I'm hearing DJ tick off some of the things I remember reading in the book. And Julie, I'll start by throwing this to you. You've mentioned sometimes maybe you do need to take that break. You offer some very specific stuff about how to step away, how long to step away. Share advice when somebody's in that position DJ was talking about, like, I don't want to say something that's going to do more damage. Need to take a little time here.
Wonderful question, Rob. So, yes, when somebody really feels flooded with emotion, when their heart rates perhaps are racing, when they really feel attacked, then it's time to take a break. So a specific break looks like this. First, a person says, I need a break, and they also say what time they'll come back to continue the conversation so that the other person doesn't feel abandoned or rejected. Very important to give that time when they'll come back. The amount of time a break should last is typically 20 to 30 minutes. The longest a break should last is 24 hours. It never should be longer than that. Otherwise, it feels like punishment. Then when you go into separate spaces where you can't hear each other, you can't see each other, it really is a break from the conversation, don't think about the fight. Because if you do, you'll keep feeling stress. Your body will keep pumping adrenaline and cortisol into your bloodstream, and your body will not have a chance to calm down. So do something self-soothing, like reading a book or a magazine, listening to music, yoga, meditation, any of those things that takes your mind off the fight and helps you to calm down. We call that self-soothing. Finally, go back to your partner at the time you agreed to, and hopefully you can continue the conversation at that point with a much calmer body and brain. And your brain, incidentally, will work much, much better than it does in fight or flight, to where you can creatively problem solve and listen and understand well.
Thanks again for that call, DJ. We'll go to Julie now in Milwaukee. Julie, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Hi. Well, thank you. I guess the problem my partner and I have, we're not married, but we've been together almost 7 years. I admittedly do have ADHD. I don't use it as an excuse. I really, truly don't. But what happens is I go to his house and he immediately starts picking on me. And a lot of times it's sort of like that hostile humor, but then it doesn't become at all hostile humor. It becomes just hostile. And I am afraid to even begin to talk because he'll use it against me somehow. And the thing is, I do get emotionally reactive because he does start arguing and then he screams. He screams at me and I'll tell him, please don't scream at me. It doesn't help. And if you continue, I'll leave. I've only been able to actually leave on maybe one or two occasions because he doesn't, because then he said, well, you're just avoiding it. But I think I need to set boundaries about not letting him scream at me, not putting me down, telling me that my friends don't like the characteristics that they actually do like in me, which is, you know, my energy, my, you know, my outgoingness, my wanting to have fun, because those are things he dislikes the most.
Julie, thanks for the call. This sounds bad to me, John, and we can't necessarily counsel people on a quick phone call. Do you have thoughts, somebody in this situation, this sounds more like more than, an easy to resolve conflict or even a conflict, maybe even worth resolving. I don't know your thoughts.
Yeah. It sounds like Julie's living under the situation we would call verbal abuse. And that is a very dangerous kind of situation. It really does destroy, people's self-confidence. It makes them feel unloved. It makes them feel really anxious. And it's a bad climate for any relationship. So it'd be really important for Julie to set boundaries, but also to reflect back what it is that this guy makes her feel. And to say, you know, if you have an issue to talk to me about, use a much more gentle approach where you talk about yourself and what you feel. Don't talk about me. Talk about you. and tell me what you need. And I'd be happy to meet your needs if I understand what they are. But when you describe me and you describe me in such hostile, negative terms, it really makes me want to leave the relationship. And I would make that a condition for staying, that he stop being verbally abusive.
Julie, thanks for calling in. I feel like you probably deserve better. In our last couple minutes, Julie, for people who have what feels like an intractable disagreement of whether to have kids, whether to move to that new city or something like that, but they know they like each other and want to stay together, how can they manage an issue like that? Very common, you write in the book.
Yeah, you know, so issues like having kids can really break up a relationship if each person feels adamant about their position. One person really wants to have kids. The other person really doesn't want to have kids. There you have a situation where, you know, you can't have compromise. You can't have half a kid, right? So that's not going to work. In terms of geography, geography is sometimes a little bit more solvable. But it really depends on the flexibility of each person. Let me give you an example. We had a couple in a workshop who were retiring, and one person wanted to sail around the world. The other person wanted to go live on the farm that had been in their family for over a century, and that farm was located in Iowa. So how do you sail around the world from Iowa? You can't do it, right? So through a beautiful conversation, they decided on a compromise where they would sail for 1 year, get as far as they could, and then put the boat up on a dry dock and come back, go to Iowa, live on the farm for a year. And after 2 years, make a decision about what to do next.
Excellent.
So there are still possibilities for geography.
Thanks to our guests today, Julie Schwartz-Gottman and John Gottman, clinical psychologists, relationship researchers. Their new book is called Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and what better way to spend a romantic evening than sharing a plate of spaghetti? I mean, it worked for Disney's Lady and the Tramp, but pasta isn't just for date night. Our Food Friday guest says pasta can really bring people together and be the heart of everyday meals. And she says that anyone can make great fresh pasta with what's already in their kitchen. So we're going to put it to the test. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever made fresh pasta at home? How did it turn out? Is this something you do all the time? Are you curious about making homemade pasta but haven't taken the plunge yet? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Meryl Feinstein is a chef, food writer, and founder of Pasta Social Club. Her first cookbook is called Pasta Every Day. Meryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I love the food part of this. We're going to spend most of our time on that, but I love the social side of things. What inspired you to start this Pasta Social Club?
That's exactly right. The social part came before the pasta. I was living in New York City and having a hard time making friends. So I thought, well, what are some other ways that we can bring people together? And pasta seemed like a really great way to get people at the table, get people meeting new friends.
And you actually organize get-togethers with people, making pasta in some cases and or eating pasta. What led you into that line of work? I mean, actually, people hire you. People pay you to do these social gigs.
It is amazing to me as well. I fell in love with pasta making. My husband and I honeymooned in Italy, and it was actually around that same time that I decided to go to culinary school, change career paths. So that's sort of where the food part trained chef thing happened. And, I started posting my creations on social media, and then, you know, people wanted me to teach them how to make pasta, and here we are.
Now, you've got a line early in the book, anyone can make pasta, even you. And Meryl, it feels like you're talking to me, because I'll cook, I do a lot of different cooking stuff, I'm willing to try stuff, but for some reason in my head, pasta making, that's fancy. That's like a fussy sort of thing, too much work. Talk me out of it.
I hear you. I've had those same experiences making fancy pasta. It can be stressful and frustrating, but actually I think in the US we associate pasta with, you know, fancy restaurants. That's where you're seeing it on the menu and you're like, can't possibly make that at home. You know, you need all this expensive equipment, but there are so many different styles of pasta, and pasta actually has really humble roots. All you need is flour, water. You don't even need eggs to make a whole bunch of pastas. And that's what the book is about, to showcase sort of the array of shapes you can make, some very beginner friendly shapes, all the way to the more extravagant.
And in my head, we need all sorts of gear to make pasta, but I learned from your book there are some kinds of pasta that we can make without a lot of tools to get started. What kind of things can we do if we don't want to necessarily go get that pasta maker right off the bat?
That's exactly right. I would say the best pasta to start with, if you've never made it before or you want to try something new, is called pici. Pici are hand-rolled spaghetti from Tuscany. All you need is all-purpose flour, water, a little olive oil, and a knife. And you just sort of roll these individual kind of fat spaghetti strands, kind of like udon noodles. Great for sharing with kids. Really delicious and versatile. So I would start there, but there are a whole bunch of shapes. Some you've probably heard of, like cavatelli and orecchiette from southern Italy, where you just need a knife or just your fingers. You don't need any fancy expensive tools whatsoever.
We're talking to Meryl Feinstein on this edition of Food Friday. Her cookbook is called Pasta Every Day. Lots of lessons on making great pasta at home. Even I could do it, it looks like. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have been making your own pasta for years, or you just tried it for the first time, or you need a little inspiration to try it, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Meryl, we've got a recipe maybe from your cookbook on pasta. One point you emphasize is you want to weigh your ingredients. Why is that?
I think it just makes your life easier. When you use volume measurements and you dip a cup measure into a bag of flour, you know, you'll do it slightly different than I will. And I definitely don't want to make pasta seem finicky, because even if, you know, you use those volume measurements, pasta dough is always fixable. It is not like baking in that way. But it just makes your life easier. You know, you're going to get a smooth and consistent dough every time. And it's especially helpful to weigh your eggs, because, you know, all eggs are different sizes. Sometimes I get huge eggs, sometimes I get tiny eggs. And that discrepancy in liquid can actually make a big difference in the texture of your dough. So to avoid the stress and frustration, weighing your ingredients will make the whole process far more seamless for you.
Now, suppose we're making our pasta, maybe that peachy pasta you mentioned that we can kind of hand roll our noodles. Take us through a little step by step. What are we doing here?
Okay, you want to go all the way from the dough, or you want to go from the shaping?
Let's start with the dough.
Okay, great. So for peachy, all you need is you can use 00 pasta flour, which is like the fancy, very fine Italian flour, or you can just use some all-purpose flour. You're going to sort of pile that onto your work surface, make a hole in the middle. You're going to add some water and some olive oil, and then start to kind of slowly bring those two together until they make a kind of rustic dough. And then you're going to knead it. And kneading pasta dough is a really important part of the process, but also the most liberating, because you cannot overwork pasta dough. So you can take all of your stress and anxiety out on your pasta, really go for it until it's nice and smooth and elastic. Then you're going to let your pasta dough rest. So go like have a snack, a cup of coffee, come back to it. And to make the peachy, all you're going to do is roll out with a rolling pin or even a wine bottle, a section of your dough into like a little pancake like a pita bread shape, cut it into small or thin strips with a knife, and then roll each strip into a thin strand. And that's it. It seems like, I think now going back, it's like, oh, that seems like a lot of steps, but it's actually really simple. And if you get your family and friends to join you, you'll be done in no time.
We'll have that recipe and a sauce we're going to talk about later up at WPR.org/food. Okay, I'm used to boiling dried pasta. I've just rolled my peachy by hand. How do I boil it? Is it faster, slower? What does it take to turn it into heated, edible pasta?
It's faster. So it takes longer to make pasta from scratch, but far less time to cook it. So that's kind of a good trade-off. But the same way you would boil your dried spaghetti, so, you know, a big pot, boiling water, season it generously with salt, because that's really the time that you're going to season your pasta, the pasta itself. And then you'll drop your peachy strands into the water, give it a little stir. Depending on, you know, how thick they are, your personal preference, they cook anywhere between, you know, 3 and 5 minutes. And then you'll just scoop them out of the water or drain them and toss them with your sauce. So same process, just a lot less cooking time.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Al is with us in Cazenovia. Al, hi.
Hi, Al from Lavelle.
What did you want to tell us about Al?
About 25 years ago, I think her name was Mary Lampert Smith, who was a writer for the State Journal, and she found a recipe that was discovered in an old cupboard in the old Friendly Tavern on the east side on East Washington. And it was a recipe by the fellow who served spaghetti and meatballs to the workers and to the families every day. And it is just an outstanding recipe. I think it's called Christina's Spaghetti and Meatballs. And I wonder if your guest is familiar with that recipe.
Al, thanks for the call. I'm guessing you're not going to be familiar with this particular one restaurant's recipe, but I love it. And Meryl, I got to ask, you know, you've got sauces in your book. We're going to talk about one of them. Do you find yourself questing for, you know, the perfect spaghetti sauce or spaghetti and meatball sauce?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, there isn't a spaghetti and meatball sauce in this book, but now you have me craving it. I think for tomato sauce, I tend to go like a little bit lighter, a little bit of a shorter cook time. I hear a lot of, you know, simmering your Sunday sauce for hours and hours and hours, which I think is definitely an Italian-American tradition. In Italy, I feel like tomato sauces take less time to cook. They use very fresh, you know, beautiful tomatoes. So I kind of go in that style, and I don't usually simmer a tomato sauce for more than about 30 minutes. And I keep it simple with just maybe some garlic, some basil. I do like to add butter to my tomato sauces like Marcella has on, because I think it makes it, you know, richer, slightly sweeter. But you can also use olive oil. So I like to keep it simple.
Al, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We've got Meryl Feinstein with us on this edition of Food Friday. Meryl's cookbook is called Pasta Every Day. She's got lots of advice for making your own pasta, whether you're a beginner or an advanced specialist in home pasta making. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite pasta dish to make or to eat when somebody else makes it? Are you a fan of pesto or tomato sauces or whatever you want? And do you make your own pasta? Love to hear about your latest experiment. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with chef and food writer Meryl Feinstein about making fresh pasta at home. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experimented with making pasta at home? Was it awesome, a disaster, or maybe you've done some of each? Do you need some advice on how to make pasta at home? And do you have a favorite sauce you'd like to share with us? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Meryl, you've got sauces in the book. You shared one with us. Again, we've got it at WPR.org/food. This sounds great to me. I love pumpkin. Smoky pumpkin sauce. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, actually, that sauce came about because I've always made pumpkin pie around Thanksgiving. And oftentimes I'll have use half the can for the pie and then have a cup's worth left. And you're like, what am I going to do with this? And so I thought, well, what if I put it on pasta, and tried to make, a very savory kind of sort of spicy pumpkin sauce. And it is definitely one of my favorites. It's sort of like, it's not going to taste like a pumpkin spice latte. there's a lot of smoked paprika and other spices that really give it some really delicious, interesting edge. And then you've got some fried sage on top. So if you've got any dregs of pumpkin in your, holiday pie making next year, definitely make this sauce.
Now, let's get into some more pasta making. You talked about the peachy that we can make without special equipment. We hand roll it. Okay, we made the peachy. We're like, okay, I could see making pasta. What do we look for in terms of gear, like pasta makers? We want to go shopping and I don't know. What do we use to decide?
I would say, yeah, if you want to have every option available to you with pasta making, I would say that a pasta machine, like a pasta roller, is a worthy investment. You could certainly roll pasta dough by hand, but it is a very dense and tough dough compared to things like bread. So it'll work up a sweat. And just to make your life easier, definitely a pasta machine. My favorite brand is the Marcato kind of line from Italy. It's a hand crank machine, and it just makes your pasta dough really smooth and consistent. But also the KitchenAid pasta roller attachment is a good option as well. It's definitely very beginner friendly to use sort of the motorized version too. So I would start there.
And how much variety is there when it comes to pasta dough? If I'm making different shapes and sizes and things like that, am I looking for different flours, different recipes for dough?
Yeah, so there are two main pasta doughs that you're looking at to make most pasta shapes. One is the one we're most familiar with, which is an egg-based pasta dough. Usually that's a combination of that 00, that fine kind of all-purpose flour, the 00 flour, and eggs. That's a dough that you would use to make flat ribbon pasta like pappardelle, tagliatelle, fettuccine, and stuffed pastas like ravioli and tortellini. And then the other major pasta dough, which is sort of lesser known, is a semolina flour and water pasta dough, so naturally vegan. And that is for pasta shapes from southern Italy, like cavatelli or acchiette, things that aren't rolled flat, but they're kind of nuggets of dough that you shape with your hands. So those are the two main ones to start with, but you can then start to experiment. You can make spinach pasta dough, black pepper pasta dough. You can use, whole wheat flour. It's really endless.
You've made pasta with a lot of people with your pasta social club. Is there or are there a couple of pastas that are these are going to be crowd pleasers? Like people are just going to freak out at how awesome it is to have made this size and shape of pasta?
I think, well, lasagna is always a crowd pleaser. And it's also, if you're doing a dinner party, definitely a good one to keep in mind because it'll make your life a lot easier. But any stuffed pasta, I think, is always a showstopper. And there are a couple of fun techniques in the book that are a little less traditional, one of which is a herb laminated pasta. So it's got whole herbs pressed between two pasta sheets, and you see these beautiful designs of the herbs on the inside. That is much simpler to make than it sounds and always, going to get a gasp from your dinner party guests.
It's Food Friday. Meryl Feinstein is with us, founder of Pasta Social Club, chef, author of the new cookbook, Pasta Every Day. Still time for you to join in with your pasta making experiments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk a little bit about, stuffed pastas, the raviolis and other pastas where it's, pasta folded over stuff inside. Now, I'm going back to elementary school. I'm bad at folding and, cutting and pasting and things like that. How hard is it to pull off a good stuffed pasta?
It's I think I have learned that all pasta looks harder than it is, especially when somebody kind of lays it out. If you think of ravioli as like a pasta filling sandwich, that's all it is. You take one sheet, you plop some filling in little dollops, you put another sheet on top, and then you cut it out. You don't have to be super crafty for it at all. There are, of course, you know, some shapes that are a little more finicky, a little more intricate. But I have seen, you know, lots of people make perfect tortellini on the first try who don't think, you know, they know how to do it either. So I bet you would be better at it than you think.
Wouldn't be hard. I think I'd be really bad at it. Now, sometimes, you know, I make some pasta, just dried pasta, and I make a sauce, and they're both pretty good, but I don't know, they don't seem to combine well. And you've got advice, I think, in the book on helping our pasta and our sauce kind of marry a little bit. What do we do?
Yeah, so what I like to do is actually, you know, transfer my pasta from the boiling water with like a sieve, a slotted spoon or a spider sieve or tongs directly into my sauce if that's an option for you. You can certainly also drain it, but if you drain your pasta, try to reserve some of the cooking water and then immediately tip your pasta from the colander into the sauce. Do not rinse it because there's a layer of starch coating the outside of the pasta, which helps the sauce stick to the pasta and makes everything marry together. And then if you want to cook your pasta and sauce, I would say 95% of the time together to get those flavors really to meld. And you can use that pasta water that you've reserved to kind of loosen a sauce if it feels a little bit dry and just kind of bring all the flavors together. So always mix the two together. I don't recommend the naked pasta on the plate with like a dollop of sauce on top. Cook them together for a couple minutes. Use some of that pasta water to kind of bring it all together and you should be good to go.
Let's bring out another caller. Char is with us in New Berlin. Char, hi.
Hi. I'm just thinking about my mother making pasta dough years ago, and maybe in the 50s, where she would put a pile of flour on a piece of wax paper and put a little hole in the mound and put an egg in, and I'm not sure what else she put in, and then she would just smush it around until it was all mixed, and she'd form it into a ball, and then she'd let it sit for a while, like your person had mentioned about letting it sit. And then she would grate it with a grater, a hand grater, right into the chicken soup that she was making.
Oh, interesting, Char. I haven't heard of that, Meryl. Grating your pasta dough right into a soup and it boils in the soup.
It sounds like spätzle, like German spätzle, or there's a type of dumpling in Italy that's made with breadcrumbs. It's not a traditional pasta dough, so it's a little bit softer, so you can grate it, and that's also served in broth. So I wonder if that could have been it.
Char, interesting. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Meryl, in just our last minute or so, if people are looking to make a special meal for a special somebody on Valentine's Day, what would you suggest for a great pasta dish?
Ooh, well, if you want to be a little cliche about it, you can make pink pasta, which is always a Valentine's Day favorite. You can infuse your pasta dough with roasted and pureed beets, and it gives it this really vibrant pink hue. So that's always a nice option. But I think, honestly, any homemade pasta is a romantic gesture because it is a labor of love. So, I mean, you can't really go wrong. But pink pasta, there's also a really kind of fancy ravioli where you put a raw egg yolk in the center that when you cut into it after it's cooked kind of becomes nice and runny on the plate. That's also a very romantic pasta that I would recommend.
That sounds awesome. Meryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Meryl Feinstein, chef, food writer, founder of Pasta Social Club. We've been talking about how to make delicious pasta at home with her new cookbook, Pasta Every Day. She shared a couple recipes with us. You can find them at WPR.org/food, a good starter pasta recipe that you don't need a lot of special equipment to make. You just hand roll it. And a sauce, that spicy pumpkin sauce that you can put on pasta. That sounds pretty good. Again, find those over at WPR.org/food. And you can keep your pasta stories coming if you have a favorite pasta memory or you are making your homemade pasta this weekend. Let us know about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get a look at the latest round of electric vehicles, cars, trucks, vans, and more. And join in with your questions, your experiences if you've been out shopping or if you're selling EVs yourself. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. When is a matchstick not a matchstick? That was a key question for a new Guinness World Record. As reported in the New York Times, a man in France spent 8 years making a replica of the Eiffel Tower out of matchsticks to win the record of tallest matchstick sculpture. Finished product, almost 24 feet tall, using over 700,000 matchsticks. But Guinness rejected the claim because the builder had ordered matchsticks without the sulfur part that can be used to spark a flame. Guinness said, no, you got to use actual matches with the burning part. But it turns out in the community of people who make things out of matchsticks, it's pretty common to either remove the match head or to order these non-burning matchsticks. I guess there's some kind of downside to having a wooden sculpture with thousands and thousands of fire hazards on it. But yesterday, Guinness reversed the decision, accepted the logic of non-sparking matchsticks, and recognized the achievement as the new world record. One that I think will not be matched for a long time. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This has been a rocky week in Congress, and it may tell a broader story about American politics in general. Earlier this week, Republicans fell short in a vote to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, in spite of ongoing pressure from the right side of the party to impeach a Biden official. Congress also failed to pass a bipartisan border and foreign aid package after months of negotiation. Lawmakers faced pressure from the outside to not compromise and to not move things forward. Here's Senator James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma, one of the authors of the border security bill, talking about his experience with a member of the partisan media.
In fact, I had a popular commentator that told me flat out, before they knew any of the contents of the bill, any of the content, nothing was out at that point, that told me flat out, if you try to move a bill that solves the border crisis during this presidential year, I will do whatever I can to destroy you.
Some political observers say this is part of a pattern that's emerged in recent years. What's called regular order, committee hearings and markups, debate, amendments, voting by both the House and Senate is growing less common. In its place, more filibustering, brinksmanship, and refusal to compromise. We're talking about some of the things that are causing this dysfunction in Congress, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the state of Congress today? Does it seem to you like things work worse than they did in the past? Do you think there are solutions that might work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today, Rob.
Now, there are probably many years where we could add a conversation about some kind of dysfunction in Congress. This isn't exactly a new thing, but by recent standards, does it seem like Congress is getting less functional over time to you?
Yeah, there are some different functional issues around Congress over, you know, a couple centuries now. And in the more recent past, you'd sort of seen Congress functional in such a way that they wanted to avoid being blamed for things. So they kind of, you know, did things in commission style so that, you know, there weren't a lot of fingerprints on it. But now what we're seeing is that members of Congress, and this is somewhat asymmetrical in terms of the parties, and that's actually a book that's been written called Asymmetrical Politics, that the members do want to get credit. Mostly what they want to get credit for is not doing things. in part because at least one party, mostly the Republican Party, has looked at the sort of idea that government shouldn't be involved in doing many things, and thus Congress should not be doing things.
Let's talk about the asymmetry there. What are the pressures or motivations on the Republican side of things, apart from, what you just mentioned, the idea that the government should do less? What are some of the pressures against compromise for Republicans?
Well, what we have seen over the years, and, you know, we can go and look at, you know, primary elections, is that both senators and House members, Republican senators and House members, have been very concerned about the threat of being, quote, primaried from their right, from people who will, you know, advocate for doing less, not doing anything at all, coming to Washington and, you know, sort of burning the whole place down. And so that is a dimension that many members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, fear in terms of what their electoral hopes might be if they work for compromise, if they vote for compromise. And you saw some of this being debated, and you played the clip from Langford, who basically was threatened by a media personality. And that's essentially what that would be looking like.
Let's look at some of the particulars this week. Now, we had that combo border security bill plus Ukraine funding plus Israel funding plus some more foreign aid funding. That combination of things that don't necessarily have to go together. Republicans had said, okay, we're not going to give you the Ukraine funding that President Biden wants unless we tackle border security. Okay, Republican, Democrat, Independent sat down, hammered out something, quickly rejected. So these issues emerge, and now the latest thing is, okay, well, what if we separate those out again and try to vote on them? What do you see in that process?
Well, this is where it's getting, you know, sort of very complicated. And politics is politics. You know, politics is about trading this for that, right? And so what we've seen over the last several months in this particular sphere with regard to aid for Ukraine, aid for Israel, aid with regard to supporting Taiwan and the border bill is that those were all looped together because, as you noted, the Republicans basically said that they wouldn't do one without the other. And so essentially they're collaborators on the other side of the aisle, in this case, the Democrats and Independents in the Senate, sort of said, "Okay, let's put it all together in one big bill," and now we have this discussion about voting that for them one for one, on their own, which may leave some people not voting for certain things like the aid in Ukraine, because there has been a sort of move within the Republican caucus away from supporting that.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at dysfunction in its current form in Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something you blame this on yourself, whether one party or another, or something else outside of the parties driving these problems? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So, Lily, what we've been talking about, this border security bill, this is something where, okay, you got to have both parties cooperate in some ways. I want to turn to the Republican House majority now. Back-to-back, two votes called and then fell short. The vote to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas ended up not passing. And another bill on Israel funding, only Israel funding. It gets funky. There's a weird procedural thing, but it didn't meet the threshold to do it the way they wanted it to. Often there's a tendency to say, hey, we're not going to call the vote unless we know we're going to pass the vote in
right.
The House. What happened?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not the Speaker of the House and the Majority Whip and so forth in the House have been counting their votes accurately. That's usually what's done before something comes to the floor, if it is, you know, potentially contentious and something that you don't necessarily want to see fail. And obviously, Speaker Johnson has a very slim margin in his caucus, as did Nancy Pelosi before him. And so it really is this question of, you know, do you have all the votes you need to pass something before you bring it to the floor so you don't end up with back-to-back failed votes like we saw?
And that narrow majority seems to be driving a lot of the issues for Republicans there because, you know, for any given vote, they can't afford to lose more than, you know, count them on one hand number of their three. Caucus.
Yeah. And again, like the impeachment of Mayorkas coming to the floor, they already knew that they were going to have two people who weren't voting, two members of the Republican caucus who weren't going to vote for that. So the question was, were there any Democrats that were going to break from the Democratic caucus? And would they hold on to all of the rest of the Republican caucus on the floor when the vote came forward? And they lost another vote in, you know, our representative from Wisconsin, Mike Gallagher, and they left the vote open for longer to see if they could change some minds. But that vote to impeach Secretary Mayorkas can come up again. So they may bring that forward again. Perhaps they will have a different vote outcome.
Lily Gorin is with us, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's talking with us about Congress and why it seems to be dysfunctional in very particular ways in recent years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on recent news from Congress, this effort to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas falling short, at least for now? The ongoing struggle to pass something on immigration and border security ongoing this year and for 20 years, 40 years, depending on how far back you want to go. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see members of both parties cooperate with each other if you support one side or the other? Are you glad when your party does not compromise? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about dysfunction in Congress with Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Congress gets enough done? Do you want to see your lawmakers compromise more? Or if you support a lawmaker from a particular party, do you want them to hold the line, compromise as little as possible? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Nancy is with us in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. My whole comment is there's 532 people that are making these decisions for the entire country. And if they'd actually listen to us, they'd realize that they're acting like they're second graders fighting with each other with our money. I wish that they could actually get something done for this country and for the people in this country.
Nancy? Go ahead. Sorry, Nancy.
Most of us want to help Ukraine. Most of us want to help Israel. Most of us want health care. I mean, that's the majority of this country. That's what they should be doing while they're in office.
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. Lily?
Yeah, I mean, Nancy is making a point that that is accurate in terms of a lot of the stuff that we are hearing about in terms of legislation on the floor is stuff that Americans are generally in the majority of supporting, as she notes, aid to Ukraine, aid to Israel, solving some of the problems at the border, and not necessarily the impeachment of Alexander Mayorkas. I haven't seen that polling as particularly high on the topic of issues that Americans are particularly engaged with. And so she is definitely making a key point that members of Congress are not always reflecting what the people want.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. One tricky thing, Lily, and it gets to something you touched on earlier. Many members of Congress are in safe seats. You know the Republicans going to win here. The Democrats going to win there. Some senators are basically in safe seats, depending on which state they're in. So is the constituency they're reaching out to the whole district, or is it the incredibly motivated primary voters from their own party?
That's generally the case. particularly in the house. I was talking about this with my students last week. As the house was originally designed, it wasn't supposed to be as, quote, stable in terms of having exactly the same people returned every time as it has become. And that is problematic in terms of, you know, what role the house itself is supposed to play in the sort of constitutional arrangements of the various branches and the parts of the branches themselves. So you do have some of this tension and pressure with regard to having primaries against you. And again, you know, this is statistically the case with regard, more so with regard to Republicans than Democrats in safe seats, that the greater concern is having somebody, you know, threaten you in a primary, and thus you lose your incumbent position.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us now in Wausau. Mark, hi.
Hi. I'm calling in regards to the fact that I don't see anybody in the House actually trying to do any work to create their own plan for Ukraine or Israel or the border. It just seems to be divisiveness and nothing is getting done. And if they're complaining about you know, nothing getting done, they're ones sitting on their hands doing nothing.
Mark, thanks for the call. Lily, we saw at least an effort in the Senate. I mentioned three people, a Democrat, Republican, Independent, on this border security, et cetera, bill. Mark says nothing similar going on in the House. Does he have that about right?
I mean, it seems to be that the House is, in fact, more dysfunctional these days. And again, you have these very, very slim majorities that we've seen in the House. So, you know, you likely have to get some support from the other side, or you have to bring your entire caucus to the table to vote for something, and you can't lose anybody. And so that seems to also be where we are with regard to the House.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lily, I want to bring in the factor of the presidential election this year. Democrats are very definitely blaming, in part, former President Trump, current candidate Trump, for interfering with this border security, Ukraine funding, and so on, Bill, saying, hey, they don't want this problem to be solved. They want to have an ongoing border problem that they can point to in the election year. Republicans not coming out and saying that's why they did it. Do you see this as a factor?
Well, Donald Trump said exactly that to the Republicans, that he did not want the border issue solved. Because he wanted to continue to run on it as a presidential candidate. And so I mean, it's not like that has been a secret. And you have, in fact, seen any number of elected representatives in the House and the Senate basically sort of saying, yeah, we're not going to solve this, because what we're hearing from our potential presidential candidate is we shouldn't solve it. You've also heard people like Mitt Romney and Senator Langford who've said, you know, this kind of interference and threatening from a presidential candidate is really terrible.
I want to look at the issue of immigration in particular, because depending on which piece of the structure, as I talk to immigration experts, some of our laws, you know, go back 20 years, some 30, some 40. There have been efforts again and again to try to come up with either piecemeal changes or comprehensive plans. And some under the Obama administration, there was a bipartisan group came out with a plan, ended up being spiked very similarly by conservative backlash. Why is immigration such a tough issue for Congress to do something, anything on?
Well, I mean, again, it's such a complicated policy area because there are so many different pieces of it. So if you change one piece of the immigration situation in the United States, that may impact and influence other dimensions of immigration policy. And so that's why it's often very difficult to just sort of change one aspect without sort of doing a more comprehensive undertaking. And you know, you saw this, as you noted, in the Obama administration. This was also something that George W. Bush was working on during a long stretch of his administration towards the end of it, trying to get comprehensive immigration reform through. And he did not have support from a number of members of his party in Congress. The last time we had really substantial immigration reform was during the Reagan administration. And as my students note, they weren't alive for that.
Let's go back to our callers. Nate is with us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. Wisconsin, I hope, is in the process of shaking off some of the gerrymandering it's been under for the past several years. But I know some other states still deal with it. And I believe it was about 2 years ago, maybe a little earlier, that Democrats in the U.S. House actually passed a bill that was filibustered in the Senate that would have ended gerrymandering for all U.S. House districts. And perhaps that would have shaken things up enough that members of the House would have been more accountable to the people voting, regardless of what state they were from.
Interesting. Nate, we don't have a ton of time left, and I want to bring Lily in on that idea, the impact of gerrymandering on House districts.
Yeah, I mean, Nate brings up a really good point in terms of how gerrymandering by the states, in one direction or another, it goes both ways, can, in fact, make the seats safer, which is usually what has been happening. And if we can sort of get rid of gerrymandering in lots of different ways, then the House seats would be more competitive.
And Nate mentioned the idea of getting rid of gerrymandering as making politicians more responsive to voters if there's more of a risk of losing in a general election. Do you think that would work?
Well, that's the theory that was inaugurated in 1787. So that's the original idea behind the House, was to be most responsive to the people who the members are representing and not just a sliver of the people who they're representing.
And thanks for that call, Nate. And Lily, I've heard the argument and I've talked to some guests over the years who say, you know, the American population keeps getting bigger and bigger and the House of Representatives population stays the same. Each representative representing more and more people, it's impossible to be in touch with your constituents in that way. What do you think of the notion of embiggening the House of Representatives?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, it seems like it's not a bad idea, in part because it used to be that a House member would represent about 500,000 people, and there are lots of districts where that's not the case. Lots and lots of districts. And so it really is this question of potentially having more representatives who can better represent more people in the House.
Lily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on today, Rob.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She talked to us today about why Congress seems to be particularly dysfunctional and the particular form that dysfunction is taking lately. Still time for you to share your complaints about Congress, maybe your solutions. Join in, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what's on your mind. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new plan in Congress aims to fix problems in the Mississippi River, from flooding to invasive species. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the show to explain that legislation. Plus, we'll get a check-in on the health of the Mississippi River Valley. And in the early days of modern medicine, researchers and doctors got a lot of things wrong when it came to women. And that has impact to this day. That's according to the author of the new book, All in Her Head. We'll hear from the author. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.